Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're doing a deep dive into something you probably haven't thought about in detail: how a city actually replaces a major water line. It sounds pretty straightforward, maybe just a construction job, but the documents you've shared, they reveal this fascinating, really complex web of planning, negotiation, and specialized services. It's amazing how much goes into even a single infrastructure project like this. You'll be surprised.
What's really fascinating here is exactly that hidden complexity. Our sources today, they're specifically a Master Professional Services Agreement task authorization and its detailed scope of services. And they lay out pretty much every single step. So our mission really is to extract the key nuggets from this agreement. It's between the City of Shawnee and Freeze and Nichols Inc., FNI.
FNI, got it.
And we want to show you just how detailed and, well, multifaceted such a critical project truly is.
So we're talking about task authorization number one for the TO1N Park Avenue 14-inch WO replacement project. That's in Shawnee, Oklahoma.
That's the one.
The goal: replace about half a mile of an existing 14-inch water line. And they're planning, it looks like, an anticipated 18-inch HDPE line along Park Avenue that runs from Federal Street to Independence Street.
Yep, about half a mile.
And it all kicked off around November 30, 2022, with FNI officially signing on December 20, 2022.
And the total authorized amount just for these specific engineering services, it's a pretty significant number, $122,040.
Wow, just for the services.
Exactly. And we'll explore how that figure breaks down across the project's four main phases: preliminary and final design, then the bid phase, general construction services, and finally a set of special services.
Okay, let's dive right into task A then. The preliminary and final design phase. This is where the whole project really gets its blueprint. It starts with something maybe you take for granted, but it's absolutely crucial: a kickoff meeting.
Indeed. And that initial meeting, it isn't just, a formality. It brings the whole project team together. It establishes clear communication protocols, like who talks to whom and how, and it ensures all the pertinent existing documents are gathered right at the start.
Makes sense.
FNI, they meticulously document this with meeting minutes. Following that, there's a thorough review of existing construction plans, land records, plus a vital field visit. You got to see the site. This initial data gathering is just fundamental to understanding what's already there and hopefully avoiding expensive surprises later on.
Okay, here's where it gets, I think, really interesting. Think about all the other stuff already buried underground. Gas lines, fiber optics, sewer pipes, utility coordination. That sounds like a massive piece of this puzzle.
It absolutely is. FNI contacts all the different franchise utility companies. They update records, coordinate all the mapping data, and critically identify potential conflicts before any dirt is even moved.
Before digging. Smart.
Yeah. They even attend a dedicated utility coordination meeting. This isn't just about, drawing lines on a map. It's really about averting potentially huge delays or even accidents.
Right, like hitting a gas line or something.
Exactly. Imagine accidentally cutting a high-pressure gas line or a major fiber optic cable during excavation. That's not just a headache, it's potentially a public safety crisis, a massive service outage. It stops the project cold.
Yeah, definitely.
So this early, really meticulous coordination, it minimizes those risks, it helps ensure things move smoothly, and keeps the community safe.
Absolutely. So with that crucial groundwork laid, what happens next in the preliminary design stage?
Okay, so the preliminary design, that involves preparing a proposed alignment for the new water line, then creating detailed preliminary drawings, things like water line plan and profile sheets.
Okay.
And these aren't just sketches, they're meticulously scaled blueprints, like a surgeon's plan showing every contour, every connection.
Very precise.
Exactly. That level of detail ensures every contractor is literally on the same page. FNI also provides an opinion of probable project costs at this stage. This all culminates in what's called a 50% design submittal.
50%.
Yeah.
Okay. And for a project of this scale, I imagine funding is key, getting the money lined up.
Oh, absolutely. An engineering report, or ER, is provided to the city, and that's to coordinate the project scope with the Oklahoma Water Resources Board, the OWRB, mainly for funding requirements.
OWRB, gotcha.
And it's much more than just a technical document. It includes, like, A general description of the water system, a site map, a clear statement of why the project is needed.
The justification.
Right, the need and purpose. It looks at alternatives they considered, explains the proposed alternative, gives design and hydraulic info, a comprehensive cost estimate, and discusses coordination with other entities. It's basically the project's full story and financial case all rolled into one.
Okay, so once that preliminary approval is secured, then the final design phase kicks in, right?
Yes. That's task A continued. This includes preparing the really detailed drawings, the specifications, and what are called the construction contract documents.
Right.
Now, a notable detail here is the traffic control plan, the TCP. It's provided as a narrative.
A narrative. Not, like, detailed maps.
Exactly. It details the anticipated closure needs. It explicitly states each block will be closed to through traffic, but temporary access will be maintained for residents. And crucially, no more than one block closed at a time.
Okay. One block at a time. That's important for residents.
Very. The plan anticipates 5 phases of construction with notes about maintaining access to resident driveways. But importantly, detailed TCP sheets or specific local detour maps are explicitly not included in the scope.
That's interesting. Why? Just a narrative. Why wouldn't they want, you know, really precise drawings for traffic control on a project like this? Seems critical.
That's a really sharp observation, and it's a crucial distinction. Detailed sheets give you those precise instruction-level plans, but a narrative TCP, it offers a level of flexibility.
Flexibility? How so?
Well, construction sites are dynamic, right? Specific methods might need to adjust based on what the contractor finds, unforeseen conditions. A narrative allows the city to define the outcome like no more than one block closed without dictating the exact method the contractor must use.
Oh.
It can sometimes save time and cost. But it does shift some of the responsibility for the how-to onto the contractor's expertise in managing site-specific traffic.
Got it. So it gives the contractor some leeway, but sets clear boundaries. What does this all mean as the design phase wraps up?
Okay, so once the design is finalized, there's a 100% design submittal. F&I provides the final drawings and specifications, then comes permitting.
Right, the permits.
F&I submits these documents to the relevant agencies, like the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality, ODEQ, for a construction permit. But here's an important point. The actual costs associated with getting those permits, those are paid directly by the client, the city of Shawnee.
Not by F&I.
Not by F&I as part of this fee.
All right, so plans are solid, permits are applied for. Now it's time for task B, the bid or negotiation phase. How do you actually get qualified contractors interested in building this thing? F&I seems to play a big role here, too.
They certainly do. F&I starts by issuing a notice to bidders. They send it to their own big database of contractors and also to selected plan rooms.
Plan rooms.
Yeah, places where contractors can view project plans. They also give a copy to the city so the city can notify construction news publications.
Makes sense. Get the word out.
Exactly. But again, just like the permits, the cost for those publications, that's covered by the client, the city.
Okay.
Now, distribution method for all the contract documents, the plans, the specs, it's all digital these days, usually through an online platform like Civcast or maybe the owner's own website. F&I uploads the 100% complete sets there.
Convenient.
Yeah. And beyond just posting them, F&I actively manages inquiries from contractors.
Yeah.
They interpret the documents if there are questions, issue any necessary addenda, you know, clarifications or changes to the bid package.
Uh-huh.
They even help conduct a pre-bid conference and coordinate the responses to questions raised there.
So they're really managing that whole bidding communication flow. Sounds like a lot of coordination. What happens once all those bids actually come in?
Right, bid day. After all the bids are submitted, F&I helps the city open them, tabulate everything, put it in a spreadsheet, basically, and meticulously analyze them.
And it's not just about the lowest price, is it?
Absolutely not. That's a critical part. They review the apparent low bidder's qualifications very carefully. Do they have the experience, the resources, the track record for this kind of work?
Right. You want someone competent, not just cheap.
Precisely. Based on that thorough review, F&I then recommends who the city should award the contract to. Once the winner is chosen, F&I helps prepare the final construction contract documents. They provide 10 sets, 5 for the contractor, 5 for the client.
Okay, contract signed. Now we move into the actual building part. Task C, construction phase, general representation. And you highlighted this earlier. It seems vital to understand what F&I does here, but maybe even more, what they don't do.
Yes, this is critical for any client, any city to grasp. The agreement is very specific. F&I does not guarantee the contractor's performance.
Okay.
nor are they responsible for supervising the contractor's day-to-day operations, their employees, or the exact construction means, methods, techniques, sequences, or procedures, how the contractor actually builds it.
So they're not the site foreman?
Definitely not. They're also not responsible for safety precautions or programs on site. That's the contractor's job.
Right.
Or for the actions of anyone other than their own employees or agents at the project site.
Hmm. That raises a really important question then. If they aren't supervising the work, what exactly is their role during the actual construction phase? What are they being paid for?
That's the key distinction. F&I's role isn't about managing the contractor's crew. It's more about maintaining the integrity of the design and acting as a technical resource, a problem solver.
Ah, okay. Quality control for the design intent.
Exactly. Think of them as the quality control and technical experts for the plan they created. They assist in pre-construction conferences, they review the construction schedules the contractor submits, and they maintain a rigorous project documentation system. They monitor contractor submittals like requests for information or RFIs and shop drawings.
Shop drawings, what are those?
Those are detailed drawings the contractor prepares for specific components, like a particular valve or fitting, showing exactly how they plan to fabricate or install it. F&I reviews those to make sure they conform to the overall design specifications.
Gotcha. So they're checking that the pieces fit the plan. Are they actually on site much?
That's another crucial detail in the scope. They make up to 2 visits to the construction site. Just 2.
Only 2 visits included in that base fee.
That's right. During those visits, their goal is to observe the overall progress and the quality of the work. They're trying to determine if the work appears to be proceeding in accordance with the design documents.
Appears to be? Okay.
If they see any deficiencies, they report them to the client. They also interpret the drawings and specifications if the contractor or client has technical questions. But, and this is important for the city's budget, any additional site visits beyond those 2, that's considered an additional service.
Meaning more cost.
Meaning the client would have to specifically authorize it and pay extra for it.
Okay, that's very clear. So construction is done or nearing completion. How do they wrap things up? Project closeout.
Right. F&I conducts a final review of the project with the client's representative,
mm-hmm.
again, checking conformance with the design concept. They prepare a list of deficiencies, often called a punch list.
The punch list? Heard that term.
Yeah. That's the list of items the contractor needs to fix before they get their final payment. F&I also helps the city obtain all the necessary legal releases, permits, warranties for equipment, and any keys or access tools needed.
And the drawings. Things always change a bit during construction, right?
Absolutely. That's the final vital step. After construction is complete, F&I revises the original design drawings to reflect the actual changes made during construction. These are called record drawings, or sometimes as-builts.
Ah, so they show how it's actually built, not just planned.
Exactly. They provide 3 printed copies and 1 electronic copy to the city. This meticulous documentation is absolutely key for the city's future maintenance work or any subsequent infrastructure projects in that area. You need to know what's really down there.
Makes total sense. Okay, so that covers the main phases. But there were also these special services mentioned, Task SS. These sound critical, but somehow distinct from that core engineering package.
That's right. They are essential, but often handled as separate items. First up in this contract, topographic and SU survey.
SUE. What's SU?
Subsurface Utility Engineering. It's a specialized process for accurately mapping underground utilities.
Ah, okay. Goes beyond just calling before you dig.
Way beyond. What's fascinating here is the level of precision involved. F&I uses an alignment provided by the city to gather comprehensive topographic data, the lay of the land. They submit an OKI ticket, that's the call before you dig system in Oklahoma, to get existing utilities marked initially.
Standard procedure.
Yes, but then they add layers. They incorporate right-of-way data from the county assessor. They use the city's own atlas sheets to locate public utilities and verify things like pipe sizes and materials. It's detective work.
Sounds like pulling together a lot of different data sources. How do they make sure it's all accurate and, like, consistent, tied together?
Great question. They establish benchmarks referenced to the Oklahoma State Plane Coordinate System South Zone and the North American Vertical Datum of 1988 NAVD-88.
Okay, that sounds technical. What does it mean practically?
Think of it like setting up a super precise project-specific GPS grid. It ensures every survey point, every pipe location, every elevation is tied to a known reliable coordinate system.
So everything lines up perfectly.
That's the goal. It minimizes errors during construction and ensures future maintenance crews can find things underground with incredible accuracy, maybe decades later. All this survey work is reviewed by a professional land surveyor, and FNI provides the city with the CAD files and detailed field notes. It's way more than just taking measurements.
Definitely sounds like it. Okay, what else falls under special services? There was environmental clearance mentioned. What does that involve here?
For this project, it's primarily an environmental desktop evaluation. The main purpose is documentation and submitting a report to OWRB and ODEQ to support getting what's called a categorical exclusion, or CATEX.
CATEX. Categorical exclusion. What does that really mean for the project? Sounds important, maybe like a shortcut?
It essentially is a shortcut, and often a crucial one for funding. Getting a CATEX means the project is officially deemed to have no significant environmental impact based on that initial desktop review of existing records and databases.
So no big environmental red flags found on paper.
Right. And that designation allows the city to bypass much lengthier, more complex, and more expensive environmental reviews, like doing a full environmental assessment under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act.
Which saves time and money.
Significant time and money, especially when trying to secure project funding quickly. However, and this is a key limitation, the scope here specifically does not include a site visit for field verification.
No boots on the ground for the environmental part.
Not for this specific task, no. It also doesn't include actually delineating potential waters of the U.S. or wetlands if they were suspected, or preparing any additional NEPA documentation beyond the CADEX request.
So it's streamlined, but relies heavily on existing data being accurate and complete. What's the implication there for the city? What if they find something later?
It implies the city needs to be pretty confident, based on those records, that there aren't likely to be unforeseen environmental issues, like hidden wetlands, within the project footprint. If such conditions were discovered during construction, well, that could trigger the need for those more intensive studies.
Which would then become
an additional service.
Right.
Potentially causing significant delays and cost increases while those studies are done. So it's a bit of a calculated risk banking on efficiency versus the chance of uncovering something unexpected.
Got it. Risk versus reward for speed. Now, beyond these specific special services, the agreement also lists general additional services. These aren't included in the base fee, but the client can authorize them if needed. These sound like the potential budget busters, the unexpected extras.
Exactly. These are the contingencies, the what-ifs, things like preparing detailed property reports, creating support documents if new easements are needed, actually going out and staking those easements.
Like putting the physical markers in the ground.
Right. Or needing permits for right-of-way access that weren't anticipated. Or maybe the big one, needing additional exploratory drilling if unexpected subsurface conditions like weird soil or rock formations are found during construction.
Stuff you didn't know about from the initial look.
Precisely. These aren't part of the standard scope because you just don't know if you'll need them at the outset. They depend entirely on specific, often unforeseen, project needs or complexities that pop up along the way.
Okay. If we connect all this back to the bigger picture, what does the overall timeline for a project like this typically look like, according to the agreement?
The schedule here is laid out with specific milestones. The initial kickoff meeting, that's set within 14 days of the official notice to proceed.
Pretty quick start.
Yeah, get things rolling. Preliminary plans are due 12 weeks from that kickoff. Then the city reviews, provides comments, and final plans are due 8 weeks after receiving those comments.
Okay, so about 20 weeks for the design, roughly.
Roughly, yes. Then the bid phase is estimated at approximately 8 weeks from when the final plans are signed and sealed. And the construction phase itself is projected to take around 25 weeks, starting after the bid phase concludes.
So maybe a year, year and a half from start to finish, if things go smoothly?
Potentially, yeah. But it's really important to note the contract states that delays not caused by FNI, like delays in client reviews, regulatory agency approvals, or unforeseen site conditions, can lead to adjustments in both the schedule and FNI's compensation.
Right. Things outside their control can impact the timeline and cost. Okay, so we've talked a lot about what FNI does. What about the client? In this case, the city of Shawnee. The agreement spells out their responsibilities of client in quite some detail, doesn't it?
It really does. And these are significant. For instance, they're explicitly expected to budget for potential change orders.
Change orders when things need to be altered during construction.
Exactly. The agreement recommends the city budget a minimum of 5% extra for new construction projects and 10% extra for refurbishing existing structures, just to cover potential change orders.
So they need a contingency fund ready.
Definitely. The city also has to designate a specific representative here. It's Seth Barkheimer, PE, who has the authority to transmit instructions, receive information, and make decisions on behalf of the city regarding the contract.
A single point person.
Important.
Crucial for clear communication and avoiding conflicting directions.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the client is responsible for subsurface investigations. That struck me. Why is something that sounds so fundamental to engineering a water line? You know, understanding the ground it's actually going into. Why is that typically the client's responsibility, not part of the core engineering scope from someone like FNI? Is it about liability, specialization, cost?
That's an excellent question, and it really gets to the heart of how these contracts are often structured. It's a common division of labor. While FNI provides the engineering design and the construction oversight expertise based on known conditions, the responsibility for commissioning and paying for the subsurface investigations, the borings, the test pits, the soil resistivity surveys, and interpreting that raw geological data typically falls to the client, the owner.
But why? It seems like the engineers would need that info directly.
They absolutely need it, but the thinking is often this: subsurface conditions are inherently variable and site-specific. Discovering what's underground can involve significant costs and requires specialized geological or geotechnical expertise, sometimes separate firms entirely.
Okay, so it's a different specialty.
Partly. It's also often viewed as site-specific data gathering that the owner needs to provide to the engineer rather than being part of the engineer's design process itself. The engineering firm then uses the data the client furnishes to develop their design.
So the client owns the risk of the ground conditions, essentially. That's a good way to put it. This arrangement allocates the cost and, importantly, the potential liability associated with unknown or difficult ground conditions directly to the project owner, the city. In this case, who is the ultimate beneficiary and decision maker for that specific piece of land?
That makes a lot of sense when you put it that way. It clarifies who owns the risk of the unknown underground. What other key responsibilities does the city shoulder according to this agreement?
Well, the client must also provide FNI with all the criteria and information about their specific requirements for the project. They need to furnish copies of their own design and construction standards if they have them.
Okay.
They have to make available all pertinent project information they possess, like old plans or reports. And crucially, they have to arrange for FNI to get access to the property, both public and private, as needed for surveys or site visits.
Right, access is key.
Absolutely. They also have a duty to examine all the studies, reports, and documents FNI submits, and to provide written decisions or feedback within a reasonable time frame so they don't hold up the process.
So they need to be responsive.
Very. And here's another big one. The client is expected to attend all the key meetings: the pre-bid conference, the bid opening, the pre-construction meeting, and regular construction progress meetings.
Active participation.
Yes. And they must give prompt written notice to FNI if any developments occur that might affect the project's scope or timing, or if they notice any defects in the work themselves. So essentially, while FNI provides the specialized engineering services, the client has really significant active roles and critical financial responsibilities throughout the entire life cycle of the project. It's a partnership, but with very defined roles.
Wow. What an incredible deep dive. It
Yeah.
really shows how something that might seem, relatively straightforward on the surface, replacing a water line, is anything but. As you've heard from that very first kickoff meeting right through to those final record drawings, this project involves just meticulous planning, very clearly defined responsibilities, specialized expertise, all laid out in a comprehensive, detailed contract like this one.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, I think this deep dive really reveals the immense, often completely unseen, layers of professional services, intense coordination, and significant financial commitment that underpin the infrastructure we rely on every single day.
Yeah.
It's honestly a testament to the sheer complexity behind just maintaining the systems that deliver clean water to our taps or carry away waste, and how a detailed agreement like this is absolutely crucial for navigating that complexity successfully.
So next time you drive over a street that looks like it's been recently dug up, or maybe even just turn on your tap at home, maybe take a second to consider that intricate dance. The engineers, the city officials, the contractors, all working together, guided by these incredibly detailed agreements like the one we just explored. It makes you wonder, doesn't it? What other, mundane parts of our daily lives might be hiding a similar level of intricate multi-stage planning and specialized expertise that we just completely take for granted.